The In Our Eyes podcast acknowledges the traditional owners and custodians of the lands on which this podcast is recorded, and we pay our respects to the elders past, present, and future. Welcome to the In Our Eyes podcast. A podcast created by the Deakin Optometry Alumni Team for our fellow alumni and students. In each episode, we will be talking to a different individual about their optometry smarts, career, and experiences, hence the title In Our Eyes. If there are any topics you'd like to hear us cover or have any questions, please head on over to our Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn and send us your thoughts. Also, as a great bonus, all of these episodes can be logged as CPD. For a reminder on how to manually enter this into your learning plan, you can find an explainer on our Instagram stories. This is a series we call Pathways in Optometry, where we talk to different alumni about their experiences in business, research, and more. Now, let's kick off.
Tim Murphy is a lecturer and clinical supervisor for the optometry program at the University of Canberra. He is also a final year PhD candidate at Deakin University, investigating screening methodologies for diabetic retinopathy and the role of artificial intelligence in optometric practice. After studying software engineering with a focus on AI, Tim completed his optometry degree at Deakin University in 2018 and began his PhD studies in 2021. His research interests include how AI and other technologies can improve patient outcomes in optometry. Tim very kindly sat down with Eliza Whiteley, part of the Duo alumni team, to chat about his research and all things that he's doing. Tim, thank you so much for coming on to the podcast for Duo Alumni, as we want to learn all about the fantastic research you do and your path to date. So a great place for us to start is to learn about your first career, which was in software engineering. And what made you want to retrain as an optometrist?
So I always wanted to get into optometry, but it just wasn't really available to me. I didn't get the marks after high school. So I had to make a bit of a pivot last minute. Computing has always been in my family. My dad's been working in IT since I was very small. I've been building computers and programming since I was in primary school. So it just was an easy choice, I guess, to get into the software world. But I never really enjoyed it. It was the easiest path, the path of least resistance, but not really a path I wanted to go down. So after working there for in industry about 4 years after graduation from software engineering and about 10 years in total after I started programming for work, I decided I'd apply for optometry and see if I could get in and make that switch. And I was very fortunate that Deakin would take me on board, and so taken that path ever since.
Wow, Tim, that's really interesting indeed. You graduated in 2018 from Deakin and worked for 3 years as a clinical optometrist. Can you tell us what you did during this time, and then what made you want to go into research?
Yeah, so I've always been interested in research. When I was doing my engineering stuff, I did some AI research, an honors project in AI. Through my engineering degree, I was working as a programmer doing support for research projects at CSIRO. So research was always kind of the plan. So even through optometry school, my plan was, and I talked to the staff about this from first year, the plan was to finish my optometry degree, get a bit of experience as a clinician, and then bring my experience back into a research setting to try and have a clinical research avenue with the hope of being a clinician and a researcher following that. So I spent my 3 years working regionally. I moved to Bathurst, and I worked, I think it was about 3 years at one of the local optometrists here in Bathurst. Wanted to go regional just to get a bit more exposure to full-scope optometry. I didn't want to be doing contact lenses and glasses was hoping for something a bit more expansive than that, and ended up doing a lot of foreign body removals, a lot of pathology treatment and that sort of thing, which wouldn't have been available in the metro setting. And I still live in Bathurst, and I still do a little bit of clinical work. I work in the clinic at the University of Canberra Optometry School occasionally, on top of doing my PhD work as well.
Working as a software engineer, were you always interested in AI, or were you in other aspects of software and IT?
Yeah, I found that the AI part was more interesting. The software development is quite a boring profession. It's a lot of paperwork. It's a lot of planning. It's a lot of testing. It's a lot of sitting down, just typing out words and hoping your algorithms work. AI was a bit of a escape from that, because you could take a problem and try and solve it in a new and interesting way. So I played around with things such as programs to play board games like chess, or you'd write some AI to try and guess stock market movements, or those sorts of things. So you could really go outside of your normal programming environment and have a bit of fun tackling these extra problems.
Wow, it's very interesting what activities you were involved in as a software engineer, and how is that informing your next career as an optometrist and within the optometry landscape? Which really brings us to what has been keeping you busy over the last couple of years. Can you tell us all about your PhD research topic?
Yeah, sure. So coming from a software background, I always wanted to do something with a software or an engineering kind of bent, while also being clinically minded in the optometry space. So the topic that we settled on was looking at optometrists, focusing on optometrists, but all healthcare professionals that look at retinal photos and eye healthcare. I wanted to focus on diabetic retinopathy screening, because as clinicians, we know that's quite a difficult thing to do. Diabetes and diabetic retinopathy, the changes can be very subtle. They can be hard to pick up. And we wanted to see if we can improve the way that clinicians were doing that. So what we've done is we've taken a couple of angles. So looking at how are people who are good at doing diabetic retinopathy screening, how are they actually doing their screening, and trying to learn things from them. And then also looking at where is this disease actually happening in the eye? Because at optometry school, we're taught diabetic retinopathy can be anywhere in the retina, and you just need to look for it everywhere. So, you know, grab your fundus lens, grab your photos, and just look everywhere, scan the entire retina, look for changes everywhere you are. So what we wanted to do was say, where is this actually occurring? Can we focus our attention on these areas where this is occurring more often? And then also, can we assess the retina in a bit more of an efficient way than just look everywhere? Can we give a procedure, a bit like we do for other conditions like glaucoma, look in this area, then look in that area, give a step-by-step guide to how to make an assessment to be more accurate with the grading? And so we've done that. I'm in the final stages of writing that up at the moment and submitting in hopefully about 5 weeks. And we found that, yes, we can say where the retinopathy is more likely to occur, at least in the posterior pole of the eye, back part of the eye. And we can also give some sort of a structure to how people should be assessing the retina. And we found that that does make them more accurate in their diagnosis and their grading.
Is that where you're looking to take the technology from, your research, and how will that inform AI processes to ensure that the AI programs correctly identify the diabetic retinopathy within the eye?
Yeah, so there's AI already out there that does that. And there's some available in some optometry practices where you can take a retinal photo, put it into an AI system, and it will spit out predictions on whether it thinks there's diabetic retinopathy or other diseases, glaucoma, and that sort of thing. So that space is already being developed. And I'd like to take what's been done there, some concepts that have been done there, and kind of turn them on their head a little bit to say, okay, if the AI can predict whether retinopathy is present, how is it doing that? Because AI doesn't learn to do these things like clinicians do. We go through optometry school and we learn that this is what diabetes is, this is the pathophysiology of the disease, you learn about all the vasculature, you learn about all the metabolic processes, and then you look at how those emerge by looking at photos of the eyes are learning these patterns. The way that AI learns is you just give it a big stack of photos and you say, these ones here have retinopathy, these ones don't. I'm not going to tell you what retinopathy is. I'm not even going to tell you what an eye is. I want you to find things that are present in the images with retinopathy that aren't present in the images without retinopathy and figure out how to detect that automatically. Find those correlations and then make those predictions based on that. So we don't really know how it's come to those conclusions. We just know that it's been exposed to this data and it's figured out how to make a decision. So I would like to flip that back and say, well, can we figure out what that AI is doing? And if we can we learn from that? Is AI doing something that clinicians aren't aware of? Can it pick up things that we're not aware of that we don't know how to pick up? So an example of how that's been done in the past is they found out almost by accident that AI can look at a fundus photo and tell you whether that's from a male or a female. Now, clinicians can't do that. We have no idea, or at least back then we had no idea that there were any differences that we could tell just from a photo. But they were able to reverse engineer what was going on in that AI, and now we know that there are actual anatomical differences between male and female retinas. So it has to, they're very, very subtle differences. It has to do with the angles of the blood vessels and the red saturation of the retina when taken with photos taken with cameras and that sort of thing. So they're very subtle things. But it's possible that we could extract that extra information from the AI for conditions like diabetic retinopathy, and we could learn things to make us more effective.
Wow, it's truly incredible what can be done and what is already being done and where the future is taking us here. And that really takes me to my next question, which is all about a paper that you and your colleagues wrote titled A Guide to Optometrists for Appraising and Using Artificial Intelligence in Clinical Practice. There was an excerpt that you discussed that the most accurate results are generally obtained with black box systems because they're not constrained by a need to limit detection to image features, which would be apparent to a human operator. So could you tell our audience a little bit more about what a black box system is?
Yeah, sure. So in the engineering world, when we look at a system, we define them as either white box or black box. So white box means we know exactly what's going on inside. So if something like a calculator, for example, we know that you press the buttons and we can describe, we wouldn't want to because it's quite detailed and boring, but you can describe how when you press a button that gets converted to ones and zeros and how that gets processed by the processor and that sort of thing. When we look at AI systems, we can't really do that. It's a black box because we know that the data goes in, but the algorithm in there is so complex that there's no way for us to figure out exactly what's going on. So we take, for example, a photo, we put it into this AI system, some sort of magic happens. We don't really know what that is. And then you get an answer from the other side saying, yes, we predict that there's retinopathy, or yes, we predict that there's macular degeneration or whatever it is. So there are ways to try and extract some sort of information out of that black box to get an idea of what's going on, but it's an extremely difficult problem to solve. So in the systems that we have at the moment, they're all black box systems. We give it some information, it gives us an answer. We just have to kind of believe that that answer is accurate. And that's become a real problem in using AI in healthcare, that most of the systems they use are these black boxes. So can you really trust the output? Is it giving you a true output? How is it coming to that conclusion? These are questions that are difficult to answer. And that's one area where I'd like to take my research going forward. Can we extract more out of that?
Tim, I'm certainly glad someone like yourself understands the complexity of these systems and what is involved. And it's fascinating looking at re-engineering from what these systems, the end product, and working backwards on what process was used. Fascinating stuff. If AI needs to be exposed to multiple wide-varying data sets in order to increase the accuracy of results detected, practically, how do we achieve this and how difficult is it?
It's very difficult. And when you're doing AI for healthcare outcomes, it becomes even more complex. So if we stick with the diabetic retinopathy example, we have all different features that can occur in retinopathy. You've got microaneurysms, hemorrhages, you've got exudates, cotton spots, so on. Each of those can present in different ways. Some of them look very similar to each other, and they generally don't present as a particular pattern. One person with a moderate non-proliferative diabetic retinopathy is going to present differently from the next person with that same severity grade. So if we want to train an AI system to be able to detect and accurately grade diabetic retinopathy in these images, we somehow need to present it with different variations of all of the different presentations that you could have so that it can learn from all of those different presentations. And it's really hard to find data that presents diabetic retinopathy in all of the different ways that it can present. So if we think about pre-retinal hemorrhages, for example, that doesn't happen very often. And if we're focusing just on, say, posterior pole retinal photos, we may not get many pre-retinal hemorrhages that are occurring in that region. And so if we're not using data with that kind of presentation when we're creating the AI, then it may not be able to detect that in a real-world scenario. But then if we take that further and say, well, a lot of people with diabetes also have hypertension, and hypertension affects the retina as well. So we need to have our AI being able to detect this is a change due to diabetes, and this is a change that's due to hypertension, and we're not worried about that because our system's focusing on diabetes. And then we've also got comorbidities of hypercholesterolemia or dyslipidemia, and that's going to cause changes in the retina as well. And then you've got age-related changes. So age-related macular degeneration, glaucoma, they're all going to change how that retina is looking. So ideally, you need a massive image data set of every different presentation of the condition that you're interested in, so in this case, diabetic retinopathy, plus all of those presentations with people with all the different stages of hypertension and all of the stages of dyslipidemia and all the stages of both of those combined. And then you add on glaucoma, and then you add on macular degeneration, and you end up with this huge, huge amount of data that you need to somehow acquire. And it just doesn't exist. So you have got some research groups. There's some large groups in China that are doing this. There's some other ones in Europe who are collecting this data from hospitals with patient consent to collect retinal photos and all of the associated information about the patients, about their general health, their age, sex, that sort of thing, so that we can create these giant data sets to make these AI systems more accurate. But we still don't have the data we need. We're talking millions of data points that we need to do this effectively, and we're just nowhere near that at this stage. At the moment, you can probably get tens of thousands of images of these different sets, at least publicly, but that's nowhere near what we need. And so that's a real limitation on AI at the moment, and something that's been worked on into the future to get all of that different, those different presentations to make things more accurate.
You mentioned earlier, Tim, that there are already programs available within the optometric space utilizing AI. And we all know, all listeners to this podcast, that since the adoption of technology such as OCT, our ability to detect and prevent disease has increased markedly. So what is the future of AI for optometrists, in particularly a clinical practice, when we have that understanding that AI is good at focusing on a particular condition, but with complex comorbidities, it really, that will be the challenge moving forward. So what do you feel the future is?
I think you'll see it progressing a little bit like OCT, in that first you had OCT systems where they would give you your printout and you would analyze that yourself. And nowadays, if we look at modern OCT systems, they give you the traffic light systems you were talking about there, giving you where does this patient fit within the norms? Is the RNFL thinner than our average person? Is that something we should be concerned about? I think the next step is going to be an AI analysis, but just giving those kind of traffic light systems where the AI might say, I'm a bit concerned about diabetic retinopathy in this patient. Go back and have another look. Or here's an area that I think looks suspicious. Go and have another look at that. I don't see it moving towards a diagnostic system, at least in the near future. There's some regulatory issues restricting that. There's some trust issues restricting that. So I think it's going to be a diagnostic tool, and it's just going to naturally progress into these clinics as another traffic light system, effectively, or another system that flags up something that should be checked again or that you should be concerned about.
Tim, we're both based in the central west of New South Wales, and I know within our local LHD, there's been a big rollout of utilising retinal cameras within our Aboriginal medical services and centres. And I think looking at how AI can assist other clinicians in detecting that the disease is there and allowing them to triage effectively, I can see that this being quite a useful tool in some of our diagnostic procedures and allowing perhaps a more not only specific but targeted approach in our screening. What do you think about that?
Yeah, and there's some interesting work coming out of India being run by Google in the diabetes space, because the population is so large there and the healthcare coverage is inadequate. So they're looking at using these systems as a screening tool. So if you've got diabetes, you go into one of these big hospitals and you have some photos taken, and it goes through an AI system and it's used for screening, essentially, to say, no, nothing was found, come back in however long, or this is suspicious, this needs to be checked by a clinician. And so in that way, it's making those clinics more efficient, because they don't have to be checking everybody. They can just check the people that are getting flagged up or have other risks, such as high HbA1c or other risk factors. So it's not perfect. You're going to miss people by doing that. But in some instances where you just don't have healthcare coverage, it can be quite a useful tool to make that healthcare more efficient.
That's really wonderful to hear that it's already being adopted in other areas of the world, and I look forward to following that space quite closely. I think a big question in many people's minds as we're looking at other industry like the creative arts industry is the question, is AI going to make our profession obsolete?
I don't think it's going to make optometrists obsolete. If we think about all of the systems that have come in so far, retinal cameras, autorefractors, OCT, all of those kind of had the opportunity to make our jobs obsolete. Someone could come into an optometrist, they get their refraction done with an autorefractor, they get some photos done, which are just checked by a trained non-optometrist professional, and then they could go about their way. And obviously that's not the way that things have gone, because there are issues with autorefraction. It's not going to be accurate. You're not going to capture everything with a retinal camera, with an OCT. And patients are just too complex to take over all of these issues or manage all of these issues with a computer system. So if we think with someone who's got a recurrent corneal erosion, there's no way that an AI system is going to be able to deal with that. Someone who's got a foreign body, AI is not going to be able to deal with that. Someone who's got complex medical concerns, they've got a complicated glaucoma that they're having trouble with medications, AI is not going to be able to manage that either. So at least in our lifetimes, I really doubt that we're going to see optometry becoming obsolete just because of the complexity of our job. I think there may be parts of our job that get done by AI. We're already seeing in the imaging space, you don't need to be an optometrist to take a good quality OCT photo or take a retinal photo. We don't have people doing perimetry because we've got automated perimeters now. I think that's a good thing. I think that means that the mundane tasks that we're not really that interested in doing, that can be farmed off to AI systems, or can be done on machines with non-optometry skilled staff that can deal with that. And so we can then focus on the important parts of our job and the interesting parts of our job, getting the refractions correct, looking at the more complex health issues, managing emergencies and that sort of thing.
I think all listeners will be glad to hear that you don't think that the profession is at risk of becoming obsolete, and certainly this will be used more as an assistive tool within a practice. You also work at the University of Canberra and work with training optometry students. How will technology like ChatGPT change the landscape for universities? With the synthesis of information so readily available, how do universities ensure plagiarism doesn't occur?
Yeah, it's a double-edged sword with the AI and ChatGPT and all those technologies that are coming out. There's obvious concerns about academic misconduct, and all the universities have seen already students who have had their assignments written by artificial intelligence. It's not really a new problem because it was contract cheating in the past. You could easily pay someone and they would do the assignment for you. Nowadays, you don't have to pay anyone. You can just get AI to do it for you. In both cases, it's quite difficult to detect where that has occurred. But there are strategies in place that universities are putting in place in order to manage that. I know that there's a lot of work going on at Deakin University to do that, at University of Canberra, University of Newcastle, and I'm sure a lot of the other universities are managing that as well. But there's definitely benefits that have come out of this too. So if we think about all of the things that we learn in optometry school, there's no way that you're ever going to remember every detail about everything. But often you can remember parts of a condition. So we might be looking at, say, pseudo-exfoliative glaucoma. You remember that you learnt about that, but you can't quite remember some specifics about it. So you can easily go onto ChatGPT and just type in there, give me a 50-word summary on pseudo-exfoliative glaucoma, and it'll come up with a summary. And because you've had that learning beforehand, you can read that and think, oh, yes, I remember now that that's what it was. Or you can say, no, that's completely rubbish. I've got to go back to Kansky or whatever to look up the details. So for a appropriately trained clinician, it can be quite effective and efficient to use these things to jog your memory, to give you some pointers and reminders of things that you have learned in the past but just don't fit in your brain. But we do have to be careful about overuse of that and misuse of that, and relying on output of ChatGPT and other language models as always being true, because as we know, they do lie quite a lot and hallucinate quite a lot.
When I was going through university, we certainly relied on Turnitin as a program to ensure that what we were submitting as students wasn't closely related to the source we were using for the information. Can technology like Turnitin detect whether AI systems are being used like ChatGPT?
Yes and no. So it's very difficult to detect when it's hard to tell for sure whether something has been created by AI or not. You could have someone who writes an essay and then just goes to the thesaurus on every word and changes the word based on a thesaurus, and that's going to look like it was generated by AI when in fact it wasn't. And if someone did that, you can't really penalize them for doing that because it is their own work. So there are tools out there. I think Turnitin has a tool for this now, and there's some other tools as well which claim to be able to detect generative AI and detect when that's been used. But it's difficult to know for sure how true that is. Could you really penalize a student for using AI just because some other black box AI system said that it was created by AI? You've got no way to prove that. So it's a challenging thing to do. And in a lot of the cases, it comes down to the educators knowing their students. So knowing the way that they talk, the way that they write, looking at the previous assessments that they've handed in and comparing those and saying, well, this is not the way you talk. This is not the way you've written things in the past. And going back to that old school way of detecting plagiarism based on your knowledge of the student and what they've output.
With all the work that you're doing, Tim, what is the best way for us to follow your evolving research and keep abreast of your information that you're publishing?
Yeah, so I'm not very active on social media. The only social media account I really have is LinkedIn, and I do put all of my academic work up there, presentations, posters, publications, that all goes up on LinkedIn. So any listeners are free to find me on LinkedIn and connect with me. I'm fairly easy to find if you search for Tim Murphy, University of Canberra, or Tim Murphy, Deakin University. You should be able to find me there. And the only other place, which is probably not used by most of the listeners, would be Google Scholar. So Google Scholar is going to list every publication that I have, and it's going to look at citation indices and people that I work with and that sort of thing. So everything will be up on Google Scholar, and it's going to be on LinkedIn as well.
Tim, on behalf of Duo alumni, thank you for taking the time out of your incredibly busy schedule to talk to us. We look forward to seeing the final product with your research papers that I know you're at the very end of, and hearing about the evolving research and what comes off it. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
So that's the show for today, folks. Thank you for joining us for this episode of In Our Eyes. We hope you enjoyed it. Also, a reminder that you can log this manually as CPD in your learning plan. For a refresher on how to do this, you can head over to our Instagram stories. Feel free to share this episode amongst your pals. Let us know your thoughts and reach out if you have any topics or questions for us, or even if you have any guests you'd like us to have on. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time. This podcast is not an official Deakin University media production and is created by alumni. The views, comments, and opinions expressed within this podcast are those held by individuals and are not associated or representative of Deakin University.